From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour could be made this week when the U.S. House of Representatives is set to pass a measure that could eventually lead to a new amendment to the Constitution. It's the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, first proposed in 1923. And you know where? Seneca Falls, of all places. Probably doesn't surprise you. If passed, it would guarantee equal legal rights for Americans regardless of sex. Advocates' fight for the amendment has lasted nearly a century, and last month it finally became eligible for ratification when the state of Virginia became the 38th state to ratify it. But there's a catch. The deadline for the Equal Rights Amendment to be added to the Constitution was 1982. So what happens next? Well, it's a complicated question. The House could vote to permanently reopen the ratification process and eliminate the deadline. If that happens, the GOP-led Senate could vote not to endorse that measure. Regardless of what happens in the legislative branch, the Trump administration's Justice Department has already ruled that lawmakers would have to start from scratch when it comes to garnering state support for the ERA. They don't want it. Well, last night, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said she would like to see the process start over, citing too much controversy over latecomers like Virginia that passed the amendment after the deadline expired. She also added that she'd like to see the amendment passed, saying, quote, "I would like to show my granddaughters that the equal citizenship stature of men and women is a fundamental human right," end quote. That's RBG on it. So will there ever be an equal rights amendment on the federal level? And why don't most of us know much about the ERA? That's sort of my question for myself leading up to this conversation. Those are questions our guests are going to help us understand today. Kind of a history lesson of sorts, but also a living history. If the ERA is to pass in our lifetimes, women will see equal protection under the law for the first time since this country was founded. But there is a debate about what that actually means under ERA. We're talking possible impacts on equal pay, pregnancy discrimination, and a lot more. I'd like to welcome our guests for the hour. Thanks to Amy Stevens. That's why we're here today. Amy's co-host of the Transformation Thursday podcast, and great to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me again, Evan.
And also with us is Beth Cordello in studio. Beth is chair of the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Polano and Farrow in Rochester. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Kate Kelly's on the line with us, a human rights attorney with Equality Now. Kate, welcome. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Amy, how did you get sort of kind of hooked up with Kate to have this conversation that you had on Transformation Thursday to begin with?
Pretty straightforward. Both Kate and I are former Mormons. And so through the joys of social media with all the news surrounding the ERA recently, I figured for our podcast, this would make a great topic. And it was, and continues to be a great topic. So I reached out to Kate and she agreed to come on the podcast. Megan co-hosted with us. And here we are today.
She's talking about Megan Mack, by the way. And if you haven't checked out Transformation Thursday, Amy and Penny, two trans women, host the program. But the podcast it's about LGBTQ issues, but it's about society. It's about transformation in a lot of different venues. Does it drop every Thursday? Are you on schedule?
We drop every Thursday. Okay. And in fact, we're just adding a second podcast under the banner, and we'll be dropping another podcast called Trans Stories that will start dropping on Sunday.
All right. So let me start by asking the attorneys on the program today to kind of outline a little bit about what ERA is and how they view this national conversation about whether it's needed and what it would do. What's the broad outline, Kate Kelly, when people say ERA, why don't I know much about this? What is it, the Equal Rights Amendment?
Yeah, so the Equal Rights Amendment is a pretty simple and straightforward amendment. The first and main clause is just 24 words. Which says that equality on the basis of sex will not be abridged or denied by the United States or by any state on account of sex. And so it's pretty straightforward. So the first clause of the Equal Rights Amendment really gives us added judicial review when women take cases to the Supreme Court and they've been discriminated against on the basis of sex, they will get a higher form of judicial review. Right now, women have a lower form, which is called intermediate scrutiny. So right now, when we take our cases, it's harder to prove that women are discriminated against on the basis of sex. Other categories like race, religion, national origin, alienage, those get a higher form of this judicial review or scrutiny. The second clause of the Equal Rights Amendment says that Congress has the power to enforce the Equal Rights Amendment, and that is very, very important, because in the federal Constitution, only certain obligations and opportunities are given to the federal government to pass laws. All the rest is left to the states. So the second clause gives members of Congress an entirely new avenue to pass laws that will protect women and girls and all marginalized genders, and that does not exist. So the two reasons we really need the Equal Rights Amendment still are litigation and legislation.
Now, understanding the opposition here, and I want to offer a really sort of intellectually honest look at the opposition over the years, because it has sort of evolved in what it is warning against. We'll get to that in a moment. Beth Cordello, how do you see the national conversation all the way up to last night with the comments from RBG about the Equal Rights Amendment?
It has a very complicated history over these past almost 100 years, with the states ratifying it and then some rescinding their ratification and then others ratifying, but after the deadline is passed. And I would agree with Justice Ginsburg in that I think it's a huge distraction arguing over procedurally with how we're here today. I think we should also start anew.
Okay. That doesn't mean that you don't think it's worthwhile, but you're saying, you know,
it's absolutely worthwhile, and I would like to see an amendment to our Constitution, but I think we start over.
Okay. Now, Kate, when I look at the opposition over the years, my understanding is it has sort of, it began, and I don't mean to sort of be unkind here, but it began sort of cartoonishly with Phyllis Schlafly, who a lot of people remember from decades past, you know, spent really a large part of her career warning against gay rights. She was worried that if the ERA passed, that gay people would soon be seen holding hands in public and ordering sandwiches and being near children and maybe even kissing in public, and, you know, think then society would fall apart. And here we are, turns out. So I don't mean to be flippant, but Phyllis Schlafly clearly was worried about this. She called it, by the way, a way to give the homosexuals and the lesbians the same dignity as husbands and wives, which I think Beth Cordello said before the program flippantly herself. Just imagine. How dare we? She also said that it was about homosexual privileges and a constitutional cure for laziness and personal problems. And it largely worked. I mean, this kind of rhetoric, she had a lot of success in trying to mobilize lawmakers to do or not do things in her career. Fair enough, Kate?
Yeah, Phyllis Schlafly created a movement called Stop ERA and was very successful in mobilizing people. But keep in mind that even the anti-ERA opponents in the 1970s were the vast, vast minority. So even at the time, you know, in 1975, there was a poll, over 70% of Americans supported it on both sides of the political aisle. The ERA was on both party platforms, both the Republican and Democratic platform, until 1976, from the time that it was first introduced. So it was wildly popular. It was on the political platforms of both parties. When it passed in the House in 1971, it passed with a vote of 354-23. And in the Senate in 1972, 84-8. So it was wildly popular. There was a tiny minority of people who opposed it. What she did was very successfully organize a very vocal minority, yep, against the amendment, but it was very, very popular. And I think it's also important to remember that Phyllis Schlafly herself ran for office twice, never won, so she actually never voted against it. The people who kept the Equal Rights Amendment out of the Constitution in the state legislatures were men. And so it's easy to pin it on her or to use her as sort of the face of the movement. But in the end, the people who kept our constitutional equality from actually becoming a reality were men.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. And so but then some of the other opposition beyond Phyllis Schlafly and that movement, it has evolved from warnings, you know, around the times of when the Vietnam War is happening. People talk about the draft. And in the, you know, in the early 70s, the opponents were saying things like, well, you want equality, housewives are going to have to get drafted and go to war. What did you make of that, Kate?
Yeah, I mean, they were using arguments that were really salient to people at the time. And so they were, you know, of course, no one wanted to be drafted. Vietnam was a complete quagmire, and people were very, very afraid of that. So they were using these arguments as scare tactics or boogeymen in order to get people to oppose it. Of course, now, The Pentagon has already recommended that women be eligible for the Selective Service, and just 1 year ago, a federal judge issued a decision that if there were to be a draft again, then it would not be able to be sex segregated, that women as well as men would have to be eligible for the draft. Now, that's separate from the question of whether or not you think there should be a draft. Of course, but that is already a moot question. And so a lot of these arguments that they had in the 1970s, like marriage equality, like eligibility for the draft, those are all now completely moot. And those arguments just have completely gone away.
So let me ask then both attorneys to address the most recent opposition and a voice that comes from a woman named Kim Ford Mizrui, who is the director of UVA's Center for the Study of Race and Law. This is what she told The Federalist about why the ERA should not pass. She said, quote, first, the ERA would only prohibit sex discrimination by the government, and that is already prohibited under the Constitution. In other words, women have equal rights already. We don't need a constitutional amendment to get them. Then she said, even worse, the ERA would harm women, because it would not only bar government discrimination against women, like current law does, it would also ban all distinctions on the basis of sex, including policies designed to benefit girls and women, state and federal programs to increase female participation in STEM fields, corporate management, and business ownership, for example, would likely now violate the ERA. It would also jeopardize single-sex settings such as schools, dorms, prisons, and locker rooms. This is because the ERA would require the government and courts to treat sex like they are required to treat race, end quote. Beth Cordello, let's start with, let's get specific as we walk through these, and I'll ask the attorneys on this. So let's start with this. What Ford Mizrui is arguing is that the ERA would now say, if you've got a program to increase female participation in STEM fields or corporate management, recruiting more women into leadership, you can't do that anymore because that is de facto discrimination against men, and the law says you have to treat them both equally. Do you see it that way?
Well, it's so circular because those things have been put in place because of the history of discrimination against women and an effort to mitigate that and remedy that. You know, we've put these things into place so we can't amend our Constitution, which would be a more permanent guarantee of protection under the law and eliminate rights being denied on the basis of sex. It's one of those things that I don't see how that would come to pass. I would be interested to hear Kate's thoughts on that, mm-hmm. but it sounds like the new boogeyman because the old ones have been laid to rest. We do now have same-sex marriage. We do now have women in combat. And, you know, we do have all these things that people feared 40-some years ago, and now this is the last frontier, you know, the programs, you know, whether it's sports or STEM or what have you, that are designed to get underrepresented groups the numbers up, you know, that could go away. I don't know that would be true. Kate, what do you think?
Yeah. I think I'm not sure if the woman that you quoted is an attorney or not. If she is, what she said is intellectually dishonest. Intermediate scrutiny is the level of scrutiny that we currently have under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, and so women are not fully protected under our current constitutional regime. We do not receive the same level of scrutiny that other cases do, and that's very, very clear. Secondly, I would say that people that use this example of, oh, everything is going to be erased and it's going to be there's going to be no distinctions and no limits on what between the genders, and that is not the case. Many constitutional rights have limits already. None of them are completely unfettered or unregulated. When you think about the Second Amendment, the Second Amendment doesn't mean that there can be absolutely no regulation. The government just has to prove that there's a rational reason for having that type of regulation. So when you think about single-sex schools or you think about, you know, particular programs that benefit women, those can still exist. There are programs that benefit people on the basis of race currently. So that argument is not only circular, it's also dishonest, that there will be able to be programs that benefit women. Clearly, the government will just have to justify why those exist. And like you said, they can justify that by clearly proving that women have been historically disadvantaged.
Okay. And it sounds to me, Beth Cordello, like the concern raised in this particular critique is similar to the critique of a number of recent movements. And the critique usually sounds something like this. You are not trying to create equal opportunity. You're trying to force equal outcomes, which, I mean, intellectually, I understand the concern, but I don't necessarily read this and think, oh, well, the government would be trying to engineer equal outcomes, all exactly the same, men in all field and men and women in all fields, exactly the same outcomes in terms of hiring, in terms of scholarships, et cetera. This doesn't read to me like a way to try to engineer equal outcomes. It does read more like a way to engineer actual equal opportunity. But I am not an attorney. What is your take?
I would agree with you on that, absolutely.
Okay, Kay?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, why are we afraid of equal outcomes? I think that women have been historically disadvantaged in this country. As you mentioned at the top of the show, women were left out of the Constitution, not by accident, but very, very intentionally. The framers of the Constitution were asked by people, including their own wives. Abigail Adams sent a letter to John Adams, who participated in the Constitutional Convention, and told him that women should not be beholden to a government that does not include them as equals or as participants. So even at the time, women were saying that we need to be included in the Constitution. I think all of these other red herring arguments, and, you know, you should just ask people, do you believe in constitutional equality? Do you believe that men and women should be equal in our most founding document? If you don't, then you're going to use all kinds of excuses. You're going to use procedural arguments. You're going to say it's too late, the deadline, the rescissions, etc. You're going to use arguments like, oh no, they're just trying to erase all difference between the sexes. None of those arguments are true. None of those are valid. If you believe that men and women should be equal in the Constitution and in our country, if you believe that equality is an American value, then we should put this into the Constitution, and we should put to rest all of these other red herring arguments.
I'd also like to call myself out for something. You ready for this? So you asked if Kim Ford Mizrui is an attorney. The answer is Kim Ford Mizrui has a degree from the University of Michigan Law School, 1993. The problem is, I made the assumption that with the name Kim, it was a woman. It's a man. Huh. So Kim Ford Mizrui is an attorney. It's a man. Warning that the ERA is not necessary. My fault. And I'm a pretty good example of what happens when you assume and you don't learn. So there you go. In real time, the host of Connections, falling on his face. But anyway.
But I think it goes to show, like, a lot of the people who fight against the Equal Rights Amendment, a lot of the people who use these arguments are men. They often use women as a shield. They often push women to the front. They often have women as spokespeople. But at the end of the day, the people who are fighting to keep women out of the Constitution are men, not women.
Okay. Now, when it comes to why there is this sort of resurgence in interest in actually making this happen, let me ask a general question to both attorneys, and then I want to ask all three of our guests if they see the benefits that some of those supporters see. But generally speaking, people like Kim Ford Mizrui have been saying that the ERA would only prohibit sex discrimination by the government, and that is already prohibited under the Constitution. Kate?
Like I said before, that is not true. Any attorney who's taken constitutional law, which is a class that you take in your first year of law school, learns about the levels of scrutiny. This is the way that the Supreme Court decides whether or not a law can withstand muster, whether or not a law can stand. It takes that entire constitutional law course to understand the intricacies of the levels of scrutiny. But really, at the end of the day, women have a separate and lesser form of scrutiny under the Constitution. And so discrimination on the basis of sex does not get the same level of protection as these other categories. That is not true. That is patently false. And anyone with any sort of intellectual honesty would be able to explain that.
Okay. Beth Cordello?
So progress is not permanent, right? I think when the ERA comes up, people say, well, look at all these laws we have in place now. We have Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. We have the Equal Pay Act. We have the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. We have all of these laws and all of these court decisions. We're okay now, right? And the fact of the matter is as we've seen, for example, with Roe versus Wade or with other things, depending on the change of who's controlling government or who's on the bench or who we're electing, all those things can be peeled back and can go away. And if it's in the Constitution, it's a guiding light into permanent thing by which we, it's a prism by which we look through all our laws that we pass and enforce, all our court decisions. And for that reason, it's necessary, even though we have a whole host of laws. None of them are permanent, and they've expanded and contracted over the years, and they're all vulnerable to going away, unless it's in the Constitution.
It's putting a foundation under what a society decides it wants to keep permanently.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
when you think about it, when you think about the other amendments, like think about the First Amendment, think about the Second Amendment, think about what's been done with those since they were originally written and put into the Constitution. The things that they protected never could have been envisioned by the original founders. And that's what we're doing. We're putting something in the Constitution that will serve as a foundation that will be used to protect women and girls in ways that we can't even imagine now, in 100 years from now, in 200 years.
Let me read what the New York Times lists as the leading lights that supporters point to, and I'm going to start with Amy Stevens on this. So the New York Times says, supporters say adopting the ERA would, among other things, sweep away discrimination in the workplace in some areas, help women to achieve pay equality and allow men to get paid paternity leave, require states to intervene in cases of domestic violence and sexual harassment, and guard against discrimination based on pregnancy and motherhood. It may also bolster protections for gay and transgender people as well. End quote. That's from the New York Times. What do you see, Amy, as the leading reasons that you'd like to see the ERA happen?
I'd like to see it a lot. You know, I've learned so much from, you know, Beth and from Kate. And I love these legal arguments, even though I'm not a lawyer. You know, they speak to me. But when we have these conversations as a society, they push things forward. And I think this is a worthwhile conversation to continue to have. You know, not only do I want, you know, these legal protections for myself and for our community as transgender people and other gender nonconforming people, but also for my daughters. You know, I have an 18-year-old daughter in college. I have an 11-year-old daughter here in middle school here locally. I want those protections for them as well, so that way they can look forward to the future and say that they know that they can be fully protected underneath our Constitution and have all the rights and privileges as that boy sitting next to them in their classes. So I look at it not only from my perspective as a transgender person, but then also how does this look for my daughters who, you know, I'm raising, that I want them to have those opportunities. And I, you know, you read that quote from, I forget his name, Kim, what was it?
Kim Ford Mizrui, yeah.
Yep. You know, and a lot of, you know, once I hear that locker room come up, my antenna flies up. Because
That's kind of what we might call dog whistle in politics. It's signaling, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, okay. And it's, Phyllis Schlafly made these same arguments, but it was about gay people 30, 40 years ago. So this is repackaged arguments, but instead of saying gays, now we're going to say transgender. And you know what? I came here today from the gym, and I changed and got dressed in the women's locker room. I'm not going to say which gym, obviously, because I'm, you know, I don't want the crazies, you know, to be able to find me because they're out there. But nobody looked twice at me. I didn't look twice at them. There are facilities within most locker rooms today where you can get dressed in private and do your thing. And you know what? Most people go into the locker room, put on their shoes, go work out, come back, grab their stuff, and leave. And that's been my experience in the gym as a transgender person here in the Rochester area. Nobody cares. And so I don't want to say nobody, but, you know, these are just repackaged arguments that keep getting recycled as scare tactics. And they're the boogeyman argument, and they shouldn't keep coming up, but they do.
Okay. Kate?
Yeah, I think, you know, the Equal Rights Amendment, like I said, is going to be, it's not a trophy. It's a platform. It's a foundation. And so it will be used to legislate and to litigate the protection of women's rights and the protection of all gender creative and gender minorities in the United States for many years to come. What will it get us immediately? The first thing that it will get us is this two-year period. The third clause of the Equal Rights Amendment, the third and last clause of the Equal Rights Amendment, is that it has a two-year enacting period. And that period was put in the amendment in order for governments, so state, local, federal governments, to review their laws and look at the laws on the books and get rid of the ones that will not stand constitutional muster. So we will have an immediate review of legislation and laws on the books and to see if those discriminate on the basis of sex. That's immediate. That's a huge boon. And so I think there will be an immediate impact on the way that we are treated under the law in our country. And then in the future, the Equal Rights Amendment will be able to be used to get all of these things that we so desperately need, like protection from pregnancy discrimination in the workplace, like equal pay laws. All of these different things will be completely, they will be undergirded by this new amendment.
All right. And Kate, sort of building on the point that Beth was making, when we in New York State, for example, hear about equal pay laws or there was a recent, the WEA, the Women's Equality Agenda, with a number of items that were passed by the New York State Legislature that were aiming to address a wide range of these. And listeners might go, well, I thought we already did that. I'm hearing, I think, from the attorneys on this program today that with this federal codification, with this amendment, that removes any sort of feeling that that could be a temporary gain, if you view that as a gain, that it would sort of make it permanent as opposed to something that could be eroded based on the whims of a legislature or governor or otherwise. Is that right?
Correct. And New York State actually does not have an Equal Rights Amendment. So 26 state constitutions already have an Equal Rights Amendment in their state law, and New York State is not one of those. So there is a new proposed expanded Equal Rights Amendment for the New York State Constitution, which obviously we can get whether or not the federal one ever happens. And so that's another anchor, another permanent anchor in the state constitution to protect us.
All right. And before we grab Teddy's phone call, couple of things, Beth Cordello. When you hear some of the supporters' quotes in the New York Times talking about men getting paid paternity leave, talking about women achieving pay equality, how much of that immediately impacts us in New York, given recent legislation? How much of that's, because I understand the idea of sort of permanent protection, but how much immediate change could we see with the IRAs? It seems to me that there may be, in some areas, yes, in some areas, no.
I think some states will see a bigger change more so than others. For example, I believe as many as half the states, you can still discriminate against someone in employment based on their sexual orientation. New York State prohibits that, but many states don't. And so perhaps, you know, how we understand gender has changed. And I think that's one of the ways the ERA will have a profound impact. Because even though, you know, even gender isn't just the biological assignment, it's how you express it, and discriminating on the basis of that still goes on in many states. Title VII does not, you know, which is the federal anti-discrimination mm-hmm. law in this regard, does not expressly protect on that basis, and there have been court decisions each way. So New York State, as Kate said, we might finally put an equal rights amendment in our own constitution. We're one of the half the states that do not have one. I think that would probably be the most immediate change.
Okay. What about men and paid paternity leave?
So, so many of the past, I would call it like protectionist laws that would seemingly, you know, that, you know, are intentioned to, say, protect women often hurt. So, for example, it's assumed that females are the primary caregivers, and there's many laws that, you know, for example, birth a child and in other circumstances that favor women because they are the primary caretakers. But what that has the effect of doing is discouraging men, for example, taking time off of work to care for a newborn child or, you know, to care for an ailing family member, so on and so forth. So, you know, it's not only the ERA would also protect men in some regards. It's not having your rights denied or abridged on the basis of sex. And that doesn't only protect women. It does protect men. That's one great example. Another example, women having equal opportunity in the military. You know, it was a boogeyman 40 years ago, women in combat. Women can now be in combat because they fought for that. It held them back in their careers as, members of the military. You know, people don't necessarily want distinctions based on sex in the law.
What do you know about military, women in the military?
I was in the National Guard, and in fact, quick story, I won't bore you. I was a medic in the military, and I was in a Mobile Army Surgical Hospital, a MASH unit. And this was back in the 1990s. Now people know I'm old. and that was before women could be in combat positions. My unit was changed to become a forward army surgical team, a FAST unit. And those are frontline positions. So I was, long story short, I couldn't find a military unit that I could join. Because MASH units were transitioning over to FAST units, couldn't be a female in those units. So I had to be discharged from the military early. So I was not honorably discharged. And so I had to, when you apply for law school, when you apply to be a member of the bar, when you apply to do many things, if you've been in the military and you've had something other than an honorable discharge, you have to jump through a lot of hoops to get to where you need to be. And it was all because I was a female and there were not enough positions available as a female in the military at that time.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
Remarkable. But thank you for your service, by
yes.
the way.
Oh, thank you.
And by the way, Kate, before I grab a phone call, what would you say about the protection that could be extended to men, especially yes. in cases like paternity?
Of course. The most important thing about the Equal Rights Amendment is that it says on the basis of sex. That does not, the word women or woman is not in the Equal Rights Amendment. So this means it protects all people against discrimination on the basis of sex. This includes transgender people. This includes men. Finland just announced that their new family leave policy is 164 days, about 7 months to each parent, and they do not discriminate on the basis of sex. So both parents get that leave. Yes, absolutely. Equally shared parenting is a huge, very big problem in this country, and men should get leave. Men should be protected. Men should not be discriminated against.
I want to try one more question before we get listener feedback here. And Teddy, thanks for hanging in there. But I want to ask a question that is not meant to sort of be snarky or trolling or anything. It's just an honest question. Kate, do you feel that what this is about is people in this country may see the role of human beings throughout a lifetime differently? Some people view women as better suited to raise children and shouldn't work if they don't have to, and maybe men better suited for executive roles. And again, I'm not necessarily defending it. I'm trying to understand. And so therefore, when they see laws like this or proposals like this, they will create sort of a framework that justifies opposition to it, warning against various things that have shifted over the last 4 or 5 decades. And that what this is really about is seeing the sort of natural order of things differently. I mean, is that part of this?
I mean, I was raised Mormon. So I understand the perspective of people mm-hmm. who think that men and women have naturally God-given different roles. I happen to disagree with them, but that's fine. If they think that women should stay in the home and that men should be the breadwinners and that is God's eternal plan, that is fine. But that should not be legislated. That should be a personal decision. If you decide to stay at home, fabulous. You will be protected under the Equal Rights Amendment and your rights will be protected. That's just really an excuse to keep women out of the law, to keep women out of legal protection. If you have a personal preference about how you think women and men should spend their time, great. If you think that other people should be prevented and that their opportunities should be limited because of your personal or religious view, that is not acceptable.
Okay. Beth Cordell, do you agree with that?
I agree.
Okay,
yes.
And so for those who may hold that position, they'll say, well, look, what you're doing is you're trying to create this law that forces a changing the landscape. I think what I'm hearing from
people, you know, like Kate says, you know, people should live their lives as they see fit, you know, and if that's staying home to care for the children, if that's, you know, having certain roles within a marriage, if, you know, all of those things, it just should not be you should not look to enforce those beliefs on other people. Mm-hmm. It's a basic freedom that everybody should be able to make those choices for themselves and not have their choices limited based on their gender.
Okay. Amy?
I think if you, as a religious person, if you want to believe and do what you want within the confines of your religion, your church, your synagogue, your mosque, whatever, that's up to you in that organization to go ahead and live your life as such and do it in your home and in your church and the way you conduct your business and the way you do your life. But when you're in the public space and you're, you know, I want that same opportunity to exist in public that, you know, the religious person wants, the conservative person wants. And that's all I want is that same space to live my life the way that you do. And when you're in a public situation, buildings, government, whatever else, you know, the businesses that are there for the public should be there for everybody in the public, just not selected few.
All right, let's get Teddy and Don their feedback after our only break of the hour. You just heard Amy Stevens, co-host of the Transformation Thursday podcast. Kate Kelly's on the line with us, a human rights attorney with Equality Now. Beth Cordero. Polano and Faro is the term, the law firm. Wow. It's Tuesday. Will I make it to Friday? Beth Cordello is the chair of the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Polano and Faro in Rochester, offering her expertise with us in studio. We're talking about the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, which has been debated for decades now and is regaining momentum. And the question is, what would it change? What would it do? And why is it back in the headlines? We're going to get your feedback after our only break. Coming up in our second hour, do you wish you could go back to your childhood and convince yourself, stick with the piano, stick with the guitar, learn a musical instrument? Well, how about today? What do you think about kids? Do you think, well, kids are too distracted, they're always on their phones, or they're lazy? Lauren Haley is a graduate of the Eastman School of Music, and her new book is called Kids Aren't Lazy, Developing Motivation and Talent Through Music. She's our guest next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Teddy on the phone from Rochester. Hi, Teddy. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. Thank you. There's a lot of things to talk about here, but I'll just say that first, I am for equality under the law and protection for women that is equal to men in cases regarding sexual assault or any form of litigation that need be. That being said, it strikes me that maybe we need to preface that money is really the most important thing generally in law. And, well, it seems like everything here. And, you know, whether or not someone has the right, whether or not they are in the right when they make a case, doesn't necessarily have bearing on whether or not they will win a case. And it seems to be that their ability to have funding is what wins that case, because it can be dragged out and et cetera. The point being is, does this law really extend rights and even protection to women outside of the predominant races, if you want to call it that, ethnicities? You know, those women who have historically had more money. And I'm talking about, will this really give greater protection to Black and Latina women specifically, but all women of lower economic ability? And it strikes me that doesn't really address this. It simply says that from now on, this will be something they can call upon. It doesn't necessarily say that society will start treating them differently or that they'll have the money to be able to take this to court and win.
Teddy, thank you. I'll start with Kate Kelly on that one. Go ahead.
Hi. I think this question of who the Equal Rights Amendment will impact and how we rectify historical wrongs against minority groups or marginalized groups is vitally important. And so I really appreciate it being brought up. I do think two things. One is that this is one piece of the march towards equality. So, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Does the law change or does the society change? And those, you know, those can be debated, but the law has always been, and amendments to the Constitution in specific, in particular, has always been on the vanguard of advancing equality in society. So all of the democracy expanding amendments have been in the effort, in the service of expanding democracy, making our society more egalitarian. Again, when the founding fathers, when the framers of the Constitution wrote the Constitution, it was in the service of white property-owning men, and many of whom were slave owners and slave breeders. That was who it was really affirmative action for slave owners at the time. And so that's who it was meant to protect. What we're doing is changing the Constitution, modifying the Constitution, editing the Constitution in order to make it more expansive and include more people. So will it reach Black women? Will it reach Latina women? That is going to be a process. But keep in mind that there are two reasons that we need the Equal Rights Amendment. One is litigation. Like you said, it's very time-consuming and pricey. The second is legislation. So legislators can pass laws that protect women across the board. And I think it's very, very important to keep an intersectional framework in mind and keep in mind who will be most impacted by those pieces of legislation. But look, at the end of the day, the women who are bringing forth the Equal Rights Amendment ratification bills in every state where it's currently pending are women of color, Black women specifically. So Black women got the Equal Rights Amendment passed in Nevada. Black women were the chief co-sponsors in both the House and the Senate in Virginia. Black women are putting it forward in North Carolina. Black women are putting it forward in Georgia. A woman who's sponsoring the Equal Rights Amendment ratification bill in Arizona is a Native woman. The woman who's sponsoring the Equal Rights Amendment ratification bill in Utah is of Asian descent. And so in literally every place where the Equal Rights Amendment is being taken forward in the United States today, it is being brought forward by women of color. They are doing the large bulk of the work, and they see the value in getting constitutional equality.
You want to add to that, Beth Cordillo?
Yeah, sure. Litigation for gender equality has had a very troubled history, and it's not been accessible to all people, particularly poorer people and people of color. For example, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, it passed in 1964, and there was litigation here and there on it. It did not really become prevalent, I would say, until the 1990s and into this century that you see more and more people filing. And it's difficult. You can file your claim with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and the degree to which it's investigated, depends oftentimes who's in office and how the agency is funded. And then you're left to go to federal court, which is a very expensive proposition. It's really difficult to get an attorney to take it on because people can't afford to pay the attorney hourly. And oftentimes the damages just aren't there to take it on contingency. And that's exactly, and the burdens of proof are high. As Kate mentioned, the judicial scrutiny is intermediate. So it's very difficult to prevail. And so the hope is with a constitutional amendment, there won't be a need for as many legal battles in the courts, and it won't be as difficult to prevail in those claims. So hopefully I don't think anyone is saying the ERA is a cure-all. Certainly not immediately, but it is a significant step forward towards equality.
And Amy, when you think about the way things change, sometimes we have these conversations as if it's either or as opposed to both end. Do we need legal change or do we need cultural change? Do we need a change in the way we understand and respect one another, or do we need the law to come in and sort of do some of the heavy lifting there? How do you see that?
I see it right now as the culture is really pushing a lot of this, and I think the legal framework should catch up to where we're headed as a culture. Even in our society today, when somebody comes out, for the most part, lesbian, gay, bi, trans, whatever it is, when somebody comes out, for the most part, they're going to be loved and supported by their family, friends, and the community around them. But yet there's still this very vocal minority that has power here in our country at the governmental level, especially the federal government and states around the country, that can still dictate a lot of what we experience as far as discrimination. So that's where I think we're headed as a society, and I think the framework of the law needs to catch up. And I think the Equal Rights Amendment is a powerful step in moving in that direction. And, you know, when we pass constitutional amendments and laws in our country, those are societal statements on what our expectations are for our society moving forward. So I think this is a great starting point.
Let me read some more feedback. Mark writes to say, at what point do we stop creating new laws to push women into the boardroom and the corner office? Are some women allowed to decide they don't want those careers? Beth Cordello?
Those women can absolutely decide that. We're just asking that women have that decision.
Kate?
I mean, yeah. No, if anyone was pushing women into the boardrooms, women would represent more than 3% of Fortune 500 companies. You know, that is just patently false. I wish that were true. But if women don't want to be in the boardroom and at the top of all corporate boardrooms, they can really rest assured that they will not be pushed into that, because women are not being pushed into that now.
Well, Kate, let me just follow up with you because before I grab one more comment, referencing something that you said earlier when you said, you know, why are people afraid of equal outcomes? I think if I'm sort of repping a part of the audience that would offer a fear of an equal outcome, it would sound something like this. And maybe Mark's email is getting at the heart of this. It would sound something like this. Everyone should have the opportunity to do what they desire, raising a family, working, etc. But when we obsess over, well, this job sector only has 60% men and only 40% women, or 70-30 or 80-20 or 97-3 in the corner office. But when we obsess over that, then we sort of imply, well, we'll only rest when it's 50-50. And if that's the case, then there's become social engineering, and it becomes pushing people in directions that they don't actually want to go. I'm trying to rep that as fairly as I can, Kate. And I am curious to know what you make of that concern of forcing equal outcome.
Yeah, I mean, again, that is not real. You know, I think when everyone is given equal opportunity, when women are given equal opportunity to men, when women are treated equally under the law, they will be more able to choose their path, and they will be more free to genuinely and authentically choose the life they wish to live. That will also be true of men. Men who want to stay home, men who want to rear children, men who want to be the supporting spouse, men who are widows, men who find themselves in circumstances where they are the financial, the one who's earning less in a pair or in a family. So I think really what happens when we give everyone equal opportunity is they are better able to choose an authentic life. They are better suited and better prepared and better equipped to really do what they want to do. You know, listen, my sister is a stay-at-home mom. That's something she was raised to do. That's something she chooses. She does not work outside the home. She takes care of her kids, and I respect that. I understand that. I think she does a great job, and she's very, very skilled, and I think housework and raising children is wildly undervalued in our society. And the reason a lot of these men can go off and work in the boardroom is they have someone at home who's doing the housework, who's taking care of their kids, who's serving all of these different roles, who are uncompensated for a lot of the work they do. And that's a huge problem. So I think women who choose to stay at home and raise their children should be in the same position as other people. They should be supported. They should be valued. But men who make that decision should be as well.
All right. Last listener comment comes from Don, who says, I heard the term a fundamental human right, and today's show gives me a chance to ask for clarification on human rights. I hear that housing could be a human right, water, broadband. How should I understand human rights? What is their source? How are we legally deciding what is and is not a human right? I understand that the founders thought they came from God, but that doesn't work anymore in a secular state. What is the foundation? Or maybe human rights doesn't have any special legal status and is just a rhetorical device. Kate?
I love this question. We're getting so nerdy, which is absolutely wonderful. And so, yes, I think the concept of human rights is actually just barely catching on in the United States. We're far behind the rest of the world as to what is considered a basic and fundamental human right. But human rights are sort of what the founding fathers talked about when they said, you know, that there are certain things, inalienable rights, rights that are rights not because of who we are or what status we have, but because we are human beings. So there are many documents that outline what our basic and fundamental human rights are that are kind of international treaties. So the United States actually has not signed on to a lot of treaties that others have. And one of those treaties is the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW. So CEDAW is the main treaty that governs the fundamental human rights of women. There are only six countries in the entire world that have not ratified CEDAW. The United States is one of those six. So I would encourage your listener to check out CEDAW, to check out what is included. But one of the reasons the United States did not ratify CEDAW is because CEDAW says that there must be a gender provision in the Constitution. So the Equal Rights Amendment, ironically, will actually be a vehicle to getting the United States to sign and ratify CEDAW and to be a participant on the global stage in really putting forward women's fundamental human rights. So that's what that means.
We like nerdy and granular, and that's what we do on this program. And our listeners appreciate it. And Kate Kelly, we've appreciated your time, a human rights attorney with Equality Now. Thank you for being with us on the broadcast today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Amy Stevens is the reason we found Kate Kelly. Well, Amy found Kate Kelly, the co-host of the Transformation Thursday podcast, which you can find wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you for being back here. Always nice to see you.
Thanks for having me again, Evan. Can't wait till next time.
And you can find Beth Cordello at Polano & Farrow. Beth is the chair of the Labor and Employment Practice Group at Polano & Farrow, a long history of experience working with people on all sides of legal disputes and great expertise as always. Thank you, Beth. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
All right. You're up to date on the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment. We'll continue to follow that one. And by the way, as we get ready for next hour, if you are thinking about becoming a member of Public Radio, this is the time to do it. We're in the middle of our winter membership campaign. We've got volunteers at 454-6300. You can jump online at wxxinews.org. We're so glad you listened to Connections with us. Thanks for being a member. We're right back.